show. We're back. How are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing very well. You've seemed to have avoided disaster actor for the time being, right? With the fires.
Yeah, you got to be quick and nimble here in Southern California. We've evacuated twice, and we creep back as soon as we can because our house has a lot of sort of stuff that's got to get done every day, and we don't like to leave it alone. But a couple times it's really been interesting where the fire is coming down the hill, and the plumes are over 100 feet high, and particularly at night, the fire seems much closer. It got about a mile and a half from my house, but seemed like it was far closer and really spectacular visually. I mean, wow, it's nothing like a 100-foot plume of fire coming at you to capture your attention. But like I was saying, I was never that worried once they sort of got organized about 3 or 4 days ago because, as I mentioned, between me and the fire, you've got Ellen DeGeneres, Oprah Winfrey, Jeff Bridges, Dick Wolf, the producer. I mean, you've got all these celebrity oligarch types that can drop a dime on the government to get action. And I just figured that there's no way that, there wouldn't be a large response to keep the fire away from us. And in fact, there are 1,100 fire trucks here. 1,100. They're from like 3 or 4 states away they've come. And the whole place is battened down like martial law. You got to have a real close ID checks to get in and out. And then past certain points, no one can go, not even the residents. But I'm in the Hoi Polloi area, which enables me to come and go, and I can see the whole thing. But anyway, it's very sort of a good backdrop to be able to discuss Winston Churchill, the person who created the firestorms at Dresden.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
with the Germany. So I mean, it's we're going to talk about Winston Churchill, and so. I'm just going to do like general points about Churchill, then pass it back to you. But the stuff I want to talk about particularly is Churchill's relationship to Freemasonry, his family's relationship to Freemasonry.
Oh yes, of course, yeah, that's a big part.
And the absolutely bizarre and requiring an explanation relationship between Churchill's family background and the Rothschild family.
Mm-hmm.
It's just. Almost begs to have some scrutiny. I have a lot of thoughts and information on that.
Now, the impetus for this, of course, is coming out next week, just in time for Christmas, is Darkest Hour, a movie about, I guess, finest hour or the darkest hour for Great Britain during World War II, the summer and fall of 1940. Darkest Hour, the synopsis reads, a thrilling and inspiring true story begins at the precipice of World War II, as within days of becoming Prime Minister of Great Britain, Winston Churchill, played by Academy Award-winning Gary Oldman, which is interesting, must face one of the most turbulent and defining trials, exploring a negotiated peace with Nazi Germany, or standing firm to fight for ideals, liberty, and freedom of a nation. As the unstoppable Nazi forces roll across Western Europe, and the threat of invasion is imminent, and with an unprepared public, a skeptical king, and his own party plotting against him, Churchill must withstand the darkest hour, rally a nation, and attempt to change the course of world history. So there you go. That's the movie. That's what the movie supposedly presents to us.
Yeah, complete nonsense. I mean, Churchill, Hitler, I mean, this was the 9-1-1 of that generation. In other words, it was just a completely fictional structure. There's no real historical or sort of existential history just unfolding type thing. All of the actors, the so-called great political leaders, were placed and are reading from scripts. I think you have, the Yalta characters, Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin. I mean, these are Masons. And then Hitler, too, I think is completely fake. I'll get into that. But, you know, the first thing that I want to talk about was to go back just a generation to look at the origin of this Winston Churchill character. And I just wanted to, before I started, just to say that everyone really needs to pay attention to Churchill. He's someone that all citizens today need to understand. Because he articulated the philosophy of total war. And total war was the absolute abandoning of any moral principle. It simply was announcing that one national entity would attempt to exterminate another, or one racial entity would attempt to exterminate another. Everything was fair game. Okay. You know, you could kill civilians, children, it didn't matter. Total war. You could use any weapon you wanted. All that you needed to do was to destroy the other side. And this philosophy is important to understand for two reasons. One, because you can understand the civilian firebombings, even though the war was pretty much over, there was no real military reason to do it. But Churchill's ordering the firebombing of the civilians at Hamburg, Dresden, and it wasn't just those two, Tim. As you well know, there was dozens of firebombs, you know, deliberate holocausts of Europeans that Churchill set up toward the last half of World War II. So there is that the fact that he adopted this philosophy, you know, has you know, an explanation for the behavior, though you don't really understand why would he need to do this. But nevertheless, okay, there it is. Now, the other reason why it's important is that a lot of time people, they can't quite believe the malevolence that I think the data suggests about our current situation. In other words, when you look at autism, right, and you go, gee, it sure is exploding. There must be some kind of profit reason. You know, big pharma wants to make money, you know. And if someone suggests, nah, this is just the brave new world. This is just the genetic attack on the public in order to create intellectual stratification. People go, oh, no, no one could be that evil. Who would be that evil? Well, the entire Allied command was that evil in World War II. And these are the people who are really the ancestors of our current political structure, right? I mean, you know, it's a wavy line, but you can trace very direct descendant lineage from the people that were approving of total war, which included the nuclear explosions over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then the people who perpetrated 9/11 with the civilians casualties and that false flag debacle. So total war is important just structurally to understand. You know, this is the perspective that the political class, the ruling class, has on the public. We are simply animals. You know, don't even have the stature of farm animals, which at least has some commercial value. But that basically we are, you know, in the same way that the Allies could firebomb Dresden and nuke the women and children of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And incidentally, there were very few males. They were gone, typically, or working someplace else. So it was pretty much just a complete slaughter of women and children with the nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. So this is the moral perspective, right? This is what we're up against, and this is why we have to fight so hard against it, because these people are... wanting us off the planet and don't really give a damn how they do it. So now Churchill, very mysterious character. His family basically owes it, or at least Winston owed most of his political clout to the Rothschild family, the Jewish banking family, mm-hmm. because they created a financial relationship with Winston's father, Lord Randolph Churchill. This was an investment syndicate that financed gold prospecting expeditions. And a lot of people aren't aware of this, but basically it was extremely successful and invested in like De Beers and a lot of the original mining and metal companies in South Africa.
This is the Rhodes Enterprise, which is also Rothschild financed.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And the road, the, these are all Rhodes. Rhodes is involved in you know, to some extent, all of these things.
It explains the Boer War, too.
The Boer War was just the clearing out of the mining interests of the Rothschild family. But in 1891, Randolph, carrying his Rothschild letter of credit for, you know, 10,000 pounds, which was just to cover his local expenses, he basically started to do research into the area. You know, this is completely funded by the Rothschild family, and you, the documentation still exists for all this. It's not something that's even contested. So he took off into the bush, and he had, you know, a French cook and four native grooms. I love that touch, right? They, you know, you want to have someone, you want to look nice in the bush, you know. He had 12 native drivers, you know, 90 oxen. I mean, I'm not going, but just this huge entourage. And so they were, they basically, he went off and analyzed the potential which of the company that became De Beer, right? So the diamond company. So now Churchill's father supposedly was a syphilitic, though it's not particularly clear to me that that's true, but that's just the story that's told about him. But in any case, he came back with quite a few shares in these corporations. So he had operated basically as an agent in joint ownership with the Rothschild family. When he sold the shares, he made over 100 times the initial valuation of the money that had been lent him by the Rothschild family. There's a legend that was actually promoted by Winston, which shows you that, you know, this is lifetime acting, that Randolph was broke when he died, and that Winston was basically, you know, kind of self-made. But that's not true, because actually the documentation still exists, and he had, you know, 100,000 pounds of the Lord Randolph Trust, which had come from the sale of the Rand mines that the Rothschilds, you know, had developed with him. So that then, you know, was the money that Winston used to begin his political career. Which we'll get into, was often basically promoted by the Rothschilds or by families that are related, you know, into this Rothschild world. Now that's Winston's father. Now this is very strange. People don't go into the strangeness, but it is odd, Tim, because the Rothschilds at this point were very...
Of course, his mother is American, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But then we'll get into that family in a second.
Okay.
But the thing is just that the idea that the Rothschilds would develop a partnership with Lord Randolph is odd, because this isn't something that would normally be promoted by Talmudic Jews. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a secret society, and I'm not claiming to have broken into it and understanding its inner workings. However, I do have quite a few contacts, you can imagine, with individuals who are in that intellectual world, and quite a few of them have told me the same thing about the relationship between Randolph and Churchill and the Rothschilds, and that it makes no sense, because they... a Talmudic Orthodox Jewish perspective would not be to share gold or silver, which are metals mentioned have having value in the Torah, with a Gentile. So this is odd. It's just something that requires some kind of explanation. If you look at the stories in the Talmud, and I've mentioned that, a lot of people who are will make the case that the Talmud basically promotes all of this hatred and murder of Gentiles, but they don't really understand how slippery Hebrew is, frankly. And there are other ways to interpret these phrases, but one thing is sure is that nowhere in the Talmud do they talk about owning gold and silver with Gentiles. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not in there. Whenever they talk about it, what they'll say is they talk about how you should steal the gold from the Gentile. And these translations are not, open to any kind of slipperiness. They have stories, I won't go into it, but it's like there's one where Rabbi Samuel, he fools a Gentile about by using strange numbers and then gets his gold bull. And then there's another story where it's kind of the same thing, where Rabbi Kahan cheats a Gentile out of gold coins.
Sounds like high finance. But
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's kind of like
cultic finance.
But,
yeah.
But anyway, you see, the thing is that that's why you go, well, wait a second. Why are these guys working with him to develop gold? Now, so the fact is that Churchill's family on his father's side not only has this very close relationship with the Rothschilds, I mean, literally developing, De Beers diamond and Kimberley mine and these incredibly valuable metal and mining institutions with Lord Randolph Churchill. On his mother's side, I was going to say that, so the Churchills are a Masonic family. Okay, that's another thing. We've talked many times about, I just noticed this odd relationship that, seems to exist and require an explanation, which is of a relationship between these high-level Freemasons and Jews. Now, not trying to go anti-Semitic here, Tim. I'm just saying that there seems to be some connection that needs an explanation, because if you look back in Churchill's family, back to, say, Lord Henry John Spencer, this would be like in the 18th century, huge Mason, very, very, senior grand warden of like half of England. You get all of these grand master Masons in the Spencer or Churchill family.
And that's where that's where Lady Diana comes from, correct?
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. You see, so you see, you have this long-standing family peculiarity, which is a pattern that repeats itself many, many times, where you see this a relationship between the Freemasons and Jewish people, which creates the malevolence and the genocide. Right. I mean, Irish potato famine. I mean, we talked about that. I mean, mm-hmm. There's just many of these examples throughout. Throughout history. And so the fact that when you look into Churchill's father's family and you see this famous Masonic family, some mysterious relationship with the Rothschild, the Jewish banking family, and the question falls out, what holds this together? And it's a really good question, because on Churchill's mother's side, you have the bizarre Leonard Jerome. Okay, now Leonard Jerome was the father of Jenny, who was Winston's mother. Okay, so who's this guy? Well, many people have tried to claim that he's Jewish, that his name was Jacobson. There's just not a lot of evidence of this. But one thing which is not disputed is that his business partner was August Belmont. Who is August Belmont? Well, gee whiz, August Belmont is the Rothschild family executor of their financial interests in the United States. Now, this is not, Tim, this is not some kind of conspiracy theory stuff. I mean, August Belmont, you know, he actually ran the Rothschild money in Cuba when he was a young man. So he was very, very, you know, quickly wired into the Rothschild banking world. He went to the Philanthropen, which is a Jewish school, until he went directly into the Rothschild banking firm in Frankfurt, which was the main bank. He then became at the age of 24, he was charged with the Rothschild's Cuban interests. And you may wonder, well, what's Cuba? Well, I rest assured that in 1937, Cuba was one of the most important financial centers in the world, and the Rothschilds were running the place. So this is a very precocious individual on his way to great power. When you had the mess with Andrew Jackson, another mysterious character with a lot of weird relationships into the Rothschild family, August dropped everything in Havana, went to New York, and basically, because there was the panic of 1837, mm-hmm. Belmont then basically takes over the entire Rothschild family enterprise. So this is one of the most powerful men in America. He's not even 30 years old. And he develops a business partner. The business partner is a Leonard Jerome. And they do all kinds of stuff together, including owning the New York Times. Now, this is very odd, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We have seen how media is extremely important, component of the secret society. Ownership of the New York Times is obviously, very important situation, particularly in the latter part of the 19th century. But the Rothschild family, for some reason, decided that they would own it together with this Leonard Jerome, Jenny's father. Now, people, they try to say, well, it's because he was Jewish, Leonard Jerome. This is like an internet conspiracy thing, I doubt that he ever was. What I think he was is a Freemason.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because they trace him to the Huguenots. And, you get to a chance to really see how vast and deep the lineup of the secret society is. Now, I'm not suggesting that all the Huguenots were Masons. However, if you actually study the religion, you'll see that at its core and at its high levels, basically, it was an educational organization studying the arts and science, banking, wow, and Freemasonry.
So it's similar, something like the Royal Society in England.
Well, exactly. And yeah. Also, basically, what the Huguenots are, in my opinion, is just one of the descendants of the Knights Templar. And you can really see this if you look at its emblem. The Huguenots had the Maltese cross, which is a Freemason symbol to this day, comes from the Knights Templar, reportedly, but it is certainly a Masonic image. And they also have the inverted dove, which is, something like if you look at OTO, if you ever see the OTO, or even the Tool Society, the inverted dove is one of the Masonic images, like the swastika or the all-seeing eye. In the OTO, if you ever see that, I could send you a link to it, but OTO has a well-known logo. It has the all-seeing eye and the inverted dove. The inverted dove, it doesn't mean peace. It means the opposite of peace. It means warfare. So that is why when I look at Jerome and I look at his background as a Huguenot and his background in banking and his ownership of media with the Rothschild family, it looks pretty grim to me. I think this guy is a lifetime actor. I think his background is secret society material. I think we don't know enough about the Huguenots to really, point fingers. But I will just point out that I see these things, these cutouts. You know, they change the name of things, Tim. You know, they, you know, it's the Knights Templar, it's the Freemasons, it's the Skull and Bones. You know, they change names, and when they do that, they seem to confuse people. I just think Huguenots are another one of the organizations that the Templars use to basically to fool, you know, people into not understanding that they were part of the organization that the Vatican had to fight against. So anyway, so this is the background of Winston Churchill. Okay, it's very important. His father is just as much a member of the Rothschild banking organization as is possible, and it's a one that's very mysterious. And Churchill's mother is the same situation. Her father is wired into the Rothschild money, absolutely. And so now you have this mysterious character, Winston Churchill. Now, well, who is he? Well, I mean, the first thing that I would point out is that he's a Mason. You know, this strange group. His father was a Mason. His family, the Churchills, are high-standing Masonic. And so this is the backdrop to Winston Churchill that I think we can, you know, I would like to present. It's just the family, it just stinks of secret society. And you see the same problem that I have been worried about and concerned about and mentioned over and over again is this oddball relationship between the Masons and elite Jewish families.
Yeah, it's very interesting because you have that background with these connections. August Belmont, the Rothschild agent in North America, who I think started the Manifest Destiny campaign, and also it was, of course, the Rothschilds, some people think, were very much involved in stirring up the trouble that led to the so-called American Civil War.
Yes.
Of course, Freemasonry has a prominent role in that as well, on both sides. Kind of stirring the pot, making things difficult. I think people like supporters of John Brown and Bleeding Kansas. Then, of course, the connection is also Jefferson Davis, you know, Skull and Bones, and the fact, you know, of course, that interesting character.
Tim, would you just detail that? Because you sent me that data, and I was just floored by that, that the whole Skull and Bones thing concerning Jefferson Davis. Would you mind just detailing that for us so we can appreciate it?
Well, just that when he was captured, he was, you know, surrounded by friends of, you know, Skull and Bone members, and of course that his attempted prosecution was dropped because, well, I think the prosecutor was a member of Skull and Bones.
Exactly. And see, this is amazing. It's just simply amazing because, you know, obviously, when you look at Skull and Bones' connections into the JFK assassination, where just everybody in the room just about is Skull and Bones.
Yeah.
And you look at this, where Jefferson Davis, who should have been, you know, tried as a traitor and executed, is surrounded by Skull and Bones, meaning Skull and Bones is promoting the creation of the Confederacy and controlling its political authority. But then Skull and Bones also arranges him to get off scot-free and walk away.
Yeah, and then you have the Freemasonry's apparent involvement not only in the creation of the Ku Klux Klan, but also in the Knights of the Golden Circle, which this conspiracy out of Canada, which is of course British controlled, that utilized John Wilkes Booth and his conspirators to kill Abraham Lincoln, and so the plot thickens, as they say. So.
Well, I mean, I think it's just clear cut. And I think we're really, you know, it's like you talk about the schematic. I love that expression because, you know, we're trying to build out a schematic where all little details create a whole. So basically there's a, you know, coherent context so that instead of the world and our history making no sense and walking with a smile on our face into genocide, we can understand what has happened to Europeans over the last, you know, few hundred years. Mm-hmm. That there's a structure of destruction. These individuals, you know, the players are all working together. These are lifetime actors: Winston Churchill, Adolf Hitler. You know,
but the background of his family is important because the Churchill family, yeah, at least even on a superficial level, the exoteric understanding of the Churchill family is they're sort of emblematic of or a good representation of the entire British ruling class. How they had gone into debt in the 19th century. To Jewish creditors, and pretty much by the 19th century, the British state, the British Empire, had become a subsidiary of the Rothschild banking interests. And so it's hard to separate the two at this point. It's one of these things where these banking, the British Empire is a vessel. The political system, Great Britain itself and the empire itself, it's a commercial enterprise that's ultimately controlled by high finance. Like, things never change, I guess. And it's the banking system which is able to manipulate these things. And it's, of course, it's controlled by a few families, namely the Rothschild family, the dominant banking family in the 19th century. Growing rich off the Napoleonic Wars, which were fed by Freemasonry. Because ultimately that came out of the French Revolution, which is British Freemasonic project. Yeah.
Yeah, and even though Napoleon, you know, is not known to be a Mason, even though he's sitting there in all the paintings with his hand stuck in his jacket, you know, his family was Masonic. It's a Masonic cesspool.
Yeah, he controls over the finances of transfers the control of finance to France to the bankers, to the Freemasonic bankers. So, you know,
right. But it's just and so we've got we have an organization, and it has, we can see, Jewish families in the banking world, but believe me, this isn't the only area that they're in. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at the political side, we look at Disraeli. Okay, now, you know, Disraeli, has a Jewish background, but purportedly converted to some kind of Church of England Christianity and was very devout. Except for the fact that when he passed away, he gave all of his money to the Rothschild family. Now, that's odd, don't you think, someone who was, supposedly, operating as a Christian? Because another guy did the same thing, and that's Cecil Rhodes.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so Rhodes is supposedly not a Jew, but, you see, when he dies, he has this huge estate, he makes it all given over to the Rothschild family.
The same thing with J.P. Morgan when he died in 1914, I think, 13 or 14. Yeah. He was only found to be worth about $10 million, which is a lot of money, of course, but he supposedly controlled things.
Yeah.
Not enough for a plutocrat. Ideally, he was an agent. Of course, his father's firm traces back to the Rothschilds, and he himself made a lot of money during the American Civil War selling shoddy goods to the Union Army.
It's just a complete piece of work. But I think Rhodes is really important because, you can see that he's a lifetime actor. And I just, because I think that there is this classic sort of structure of thinking that debt is the primary tool. Mm-hmm. And I disagree. I think that there's some kind of family, ethnic, religious oath taking, something beyond debt. I think debt is part of it. But if you look at Rhodes, Rhodes is just wealthy beyond anything imaginable. And he was obviously in the thrall of the Rothschild family.
Mm-hmm.
There's letters written during the Boer War that indicate that Rhodes, Baron Rothschild, and Kipling, Rudyard Kipling, were together basically overseeing the entire, military operation. So there's something here that is beyond debt. There's some now I think with Kipling obviously is the Masonry. Rhodes, don't know, what is the background? But my point is, this is a critical question, is what is the kind of centrifugal energy? And it might not be just one thing. It might be debt in some cases, ethnicity in others, oath-taking in others. There might be a series of things. But whatever they are, we've got to find out how the organization stays in existence and keeps itself secret. And because, we need to know that in order to be able to defend ourselves against it.
Mm-hmm. And Rhodes is an interesting figure because it does factor into Churchill later career, careers in both wars, because Churchill's success in both wars and stirring up incidences or drawing the United States into both world wars to bail the British Empire out, I think goes back to Rhodes and the Rhodes Trust effort or enterprise to of this great rapprochement between the United States and Great Britain. what started with the Union Now movement and these things, where this sort of this cultural campaign to bind the English speaking peoples, as Churchill would say, into one Anglo-American empire. And this was the great enterprise of the early 20th century, and it paid off for him because, of course, the British Empire was bankrupted in both world wars. The power shifted over to North America, not changing hands, but just shifting, changing vessels, as the British Empire became an exhausted husk,
right?
You know, and became the new empire, the Anglo-American, the American Empire, probably more as the Anglo-American Zio Empire after the Second World War. But with the world, with the World War, we look at Churchill. Churchill is an icon, is sort of this King Leonidas of the 20th century, as people come to understand.
I love that expression. I mean, yeah. Oh my God, this pathetic drunk, you know, the yeah. Leonidas. But I mean, there it is. Yeah.
I don't know how true the story of the 300 is. You know, but
probably not very accurate.
Yeah. So that's just. But anyway, myths are very powerful. Of course, the Churchill myth is very powerful. Churchill as an icon, and the conventional picture we get of Winston Churchill, as being portrayed in this latest, you know, thing to come out of Hollywood, especially its role during the Second World War, and it's interesting to remember that much of our understanding of Winston Churchill's role in the Second World War. Was created by Winston himself. He famously, I think, said that history will be very kind to me because I intend to write it.
Right, yeah.
And so much of our understanding comes from his very well-written, multi, book. Multi-volume book of the Second World War. It's a very well-written. He could write very well. So that's our understanding of Churchill, the Churchill legend, and it's been adopted. I think it was adopted by the international establishment, the Anglo-American Zio Empire, because it serves its purposes. The symbol of Winston Churchill, he's sort of a totem now for the Anglo-American Zio establishment, because what he stands for is constant interventionism, constant war, this Manichaean view of the world of the heroic allies or the heroic West versus the benighted and evil East or other, you know, this sort of thing. And this is the myth, of course, the coming out of the Second World War was a Manichaean struggle between clear good and good evil, black versus white, like a, you know, very Masonic. So, yeah. And his of course, his image was helped by his rhetoric. He was very good rhetorician. The spoken word and written word, he was very good at doing. But the reality is he was in many ways a very typical grubby politician, opportunistic, switching parties three or four times, switching the positions. To the extent that, it's England's, the darkest hour, England's finest hour, was largely the extent of the policies that Winston Churchill had promoted and carried out. That is, the plight that England found itself in 1940 was a result of Winston Churchill's policies. He's never held to account for that. I mean, he was a champion of the First World War. He was an advocate of Britain abandoning its policy of splendid isolation and actually getting involved in a war on the continent, and this is their entente cordiale with France, these things, and this had disastrous consequences because it helped lead to the First World War. Of course, you and I both know this wasn't just a mistake. It was a long, drawn-out plan. This goes back to the Mackinder Doctrine, and it was essential for Great Britain to smash German and Russian power, and they can only do this by two world wars, by getting these countries, which by all rational estimation should actually be united against the sea power, actually got them to fight one another in both these wars, and for the First and Second World War. You have the even the economic policies in the 1920s. People have to really go into the deep in the rich. People think he just emerged in 1940 as a hero. Well, no, but there's a historical context to the plight of 1940, the conditions of 1940. Of course, there's the First War, the aftermath, the economic policies. As the Chancellor of the Exchequer, he was a big advocate of the English pound maintaining parity with the U.S. dollar. Of course, that was absurd because the English pound had been incredibly inflated during the war to help pay for the war. But what happened was this is the bankers, Benjamin Strong, the newly opened New York Fed, working along with the Bank of England, Montague Norman, who's also very good friends with Hammock Schacht, the German bank, central banker. So, and I think they're all Masons. But anyway, by trying to maintain parity with the dollar, it required that the dollar be heavily overvalued, okay, or inflated rather, not inflated, and this created the boom, the economic conditions that led to the Great Crash. Now, you and I both strongly suspect, that Great Crash was another disaster knowingly brought on to bring about, the Great War, the Second World War, create a crisis in Germany and these things. But nevertheless, I don't know if Winston was aware of that. It was probably above his pay grade. He's advocating these policies. And into the 1930s, we mentioned the influence of Jewish families and the Churchill family is in the 1930s, his sudden switch to become strongly anti-Hitler coincides with his, in 1937, being bailed out by this group called The Focus, just as a sort of cabal of Jewish financiers.
Yeah, why don't you just detail The Focus for us for a second?
The Focus was a group of very wealthy Jewish financiers, and they started advocating certain policies. It's very much, like AIPAC is today. And they, 1937, Churchill had lost his fortune in the stock market crash. There was another stock market crash in 1937, and he's on the verge of having to sell his estate. And all of a sudden, they pumped in like £50,000, which is equivalent to like $2 million. And it was at that point that Churchill started advocating a strong stance towards Hitler, Nazi Germany. And there was Strakosch was his name. I have the notes here.
Announce it.
Strakosch.
That would be my shot.
Yeah, here we go. he says, in 1936, he forged links with an informal London pressure group known as the Focus, whose purpose was to open the eyes of the British public to one great menace, Nazi Germany. The great bulk of its finance came from rich British Jews, such as Sir Robert Mund, Sir Robert Wehrle Cohn, managing director of Shell, and latter contributed £50,000. The Focus was to be useful in expanding Churchill's network of contacts and pushing for entry into his cabinet. He was bailed out, more or less. You can call that a bribe or not, but that coincided with Churchill changing his public stances on things. So this leads up to the war. Of course, we're talking about 1940, and it was the Britain's blank check to Poland, which created the crisis, dispute with Germany and Poland regarding the Danzig Corridor and these things. So Germany goes to war over Poland, then does nothing. There's the crisis in the spring of 1940 when Germany beats Britain to the punch, invades Norway, then goes to the Low Countries and drives through France. France collapses in the late spring of 1940. This brings Churchill to power. Of course, I think the disaster in Norway was largely Churchill's doing too. But nevertheless, this causes Chamberlain's fall from power. He becomes prime minister. France collapses, capitulates June 22nd, 1940. We have Dunkirk, and a movie was made last year about that. Another British victory, I guess. I think Churchill gave the order, told the soldiers advance to the seas.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, Dunkirk is extremely important to understand. Whenever Hollywood makes these mind control movies, it's always important to sort of pay attention and try to see what they were. And I mean, Dunkirk is basically strong evidence that you're dealing with a theatrical event.
Because nothing, because Hitler doesn't do anything, yeah.
Right. I mean, there's the idea that he doesn't invade Dunkirk when they were just sitting ducks and could have wiped out the entire British army, but then does invade Russia.
Yes.
Right. I mean, it makes where they say, well, Hitler was insane. Yeah. Well, I mean, no one is that insane. How about another explanation? Well, the explanation is that Hitler was a lifetime actor. That what was being structured with World War II was basically the destruction of Europeans. It's sort of like a civil war in the Americas where, the more you kill, the better things are for the oligarchs.
Mm-hmm. And the same people that financed Churchill's bailout were behind financing the rise of Adolf Hitler.
Well, exactly right. In fact, now let's just back up one second, because we remember in the show we did where we talked about British Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
And Churchill is directly in this stream. I mean, the Spencers, I mean, these groups are the British Zionists. So that people think that Zionism comes from Jews. No, it doesn't. It comes from the British Masonic world, comes from Palmerston, Lord Palmerston. These guys, they invented it in the middle of the 19th century, 1848. This was long before you had any kind of Jewish promotion of the idea of European Jews moving to Palestine. The British Zionists had this idea, starting with Palmerston in 1848. Churchill was a direct descendant of this, line of thinking, and so that's that's the context that then you can see, Churchill's connections into the Zionism. That follows World War II and World War I. I mean, he's part of the Masonic Anglo political class that creates Zionism. That's really, I think, an important way to understand Winston is who is he? Where does he come from? It's Masonic, but it's Zionist Masonic. It's this particular version of Masonry that Britain developed. Now, To link back to what you were saying, the reason why this is important is that then the Tool Society, which comes from this group, develops the Nazi Party. Mm-hmm. The Nazi Party, there's a few iterations, but they're really just veneers. I mean, it's a straight shot with the occultism, with the symbol of the swastika. You know, that it is a straight shot from the British Zionists into the Nazi Party. And so now when you come back to Dunkirk, right, you're obviously looking at, you are most likely looking at just a kind of scripted event, right, where the Nazi Party is just being established so that you can have someone at the at the head of it who has the political will and control to just hold the army in place and let the whole nation get slaughtered. Mm-hmm. This leads us back to, well, why does Churchill create this concept of total war?
Yeah.
Right? What is the purpose of total war? It makes no sense in terms of military or political structure. Well, it's just racial genocide. I mean, that's how it makes sense, is that this group, this combination of Rothschild family, banking family, Jewish kind of, Moses has this whole lineage, has some kind of relationship. And you can see it over and over again, Tim, with this Masonic lineage that produces Zionism. And then the result is genocide of the European. So, how does all this get unraveled? How does this get explained?
You also have that with... in the run-up to the war with King Edward, his abdication,
yeah,
in Wallace Simpson, this divorcee, and yeah. Of course, that's the official story. It was love conquers all, this romance, and that's why he gave up the throne for this woman. Yeah, right. What you really had there, if you look at it, because I think Quigley talks about this Tragedy of Hope, and talks about the British in the late 30s constructed this false dialectic in Great Britain to lure Hitler into hoping that he would sign a separate peace eventually with Great Britain, because there was the appeasement faction in Britain, and there was a confrontational faction in Britain, represented by Winston Churchill, and so the idea was there is this was never a genuine conflict within British policy circles. It was there to lure Hitler, so Hitler would go to war, and thinking he could get a separate peace with Britain, so he'd go off this crazy crusade against Bolshevism in the East. But this is, again, this is an attempt to drag out the war, to provoke the war, and expand the war, to create the dialectic in the post-war process, creating a bipolar world, which is necessary to move to a unipolar world, which we call the New World Order.
Yeah.
And so you have all this intrigue going on. It's nothing how it's presented. But we get, it just brings, of course, Dunkirk leads us to... Hitler goes to Paris, tours Paris, and goes back home. And you have these pictures of the Nazi general staff staring at the White Cliffs of Dover. You can see them from across the channel. And this myth of this impending invasion. Of course, there's never any real... There's Operation Sea Lion, never had any serious plans to invade Great Britain because they simply didn't have, even if they wanted to, they didn't
Well,
have
if they wanted to invade, they would have wiped out the army in Dunkirk.
Yeah. Yeah, they would have, yeah, exactly. They didn't do that. So
Hitler was not going to invade Great Britain because that's where the Allies were using the staging area to come and destroy the German people.
But yeah, it just because, of course, this movie, of course, next week, I haven't seen it yet, but it portrays this desperate hours, this darkest hours of the Battle of Britain. And what's important to know about the Battle of Britain was that it starts, I believe, late July 1940, roughly, August, September, it peaks. And most of it actually was the Luftwaffe fighting the RAF over the channel, trying to knock out radar stations, bombing military targets, primarily in Great Britain. What happens is Churchill...
Stupid. Two missiles and some bombs getting dropped. There was no war against Britain that the Germans, you know, they just didn't do it. Churchill didn't permit any of these things.
Churchill orders a bombing of Berlin to provoke Hitler, to bomb London, and Joseph Kennedy in his diary said this was done intentionally because that way Churchill wouldn't have to deal with any peace advocates in Great Britain. You know, apparently there were advocates signed separate peace, because after 1940s, that's signed almost like Napoleon in 1802, the Peace of Amiens, where, you know, they signed a separate peace for a little while, and this is what you do. But Churchill, of course, you know, advocated fighting on, despite the fact that they'd been pushed off the continent and no real means to bring the war to Hitler at that point without getting American in the war, which it does, just like it did in 1914 with the Lusitania. But what happens is the key point is that, of course, this movie is about the Battle of Britain, and particularly what they've called the Blitz, the bombing of London, the savage bombing of London. Of course, it compares nothing to what the Anglo-American bombing campaign would do to Germany. 10-to-1 casualty losses and things like that.
100-to-1.
100, yeah, probably 101.
100-to-1.
But the point is, Churchill wanted London to be bombed.
Yeah.
I doubt this movie's going to portray that, but that was, he wanted more suffering, because that's that way you stir up more war fever and you destroy the advocates of peace. And what's funny thing is they claimed in 1944-45 that they were bombing Germany to make the leaders sue for peace. But the experience is when you bomb a country, it actually stiffens resolve. It actually supports the government.
Of course.
It doesn't never achieves a peace because people get mad when you're dropping bombs on them and they want to fight back.
The reason that they, you know, and first of all, I mean, I think that there is nothing but the behavior of actors and a fictional script in World War II. There's very little of it that I think has any sort of basis in what I call existential reality. These are just, you know, scripted events to create plausible narratives. And they wanted Hitler to drop a few bombs in London and kill a few kids and terrorize the civilians, even though it has no military function at all, because this will justify total war. Look, the whole purpose of what they're doing is to set up the psychological condition whereby the American and British public will accept total war, that they won't go, oh, gee, why are we exterminating an entire continent of people, right? What is that? What is the purpose of that? In other words, that's what this is all about. Then you've got, you know, the Skull and Bone cesspool Life magazine, you know, with all of the pictures of the little kids and the, you know, a doll lying in the rubble of a bombed out thing. And then, of course, they go into the Holocaust stuff to some extent toward the end of the war. And this is what is the purpose of all this? Hey, it's just like they're going to wipe out a people. They don't want anyone to, you know, these peaceniks to stand up and go, wait a second, what about some kind of moral structure to what we're doing? We're worse than they are. We're 100 times more barbaric than these people. What do we stand for? Total war is very hard to justify intellectually. In fact, it can't be justified intellectually. So you need to have an emotional battering ram of intimidation to keep people from stopping you. And that's why the whole war was set up in this way, so that you could have total war on Germany and nuclear bombs on the Japs.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think it was during the Blitz that the British government actually distributed gas masks, knowing full well there's no threat of a gas attack on London, just to scare people. And that sort of antebrates foretells the drop, you know, drop and roll, or the you know, the campaign in the 50s with in America with a nuclear bomb, where they said you have to drop, you know, under your desk or something. The Edward Bernays public. Yeah.
Duck and Cover.
The Duck and Cover. They actually had a duck character, Duck and Cover, like the Donald Duck.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's nonsensical. This isn't done as a measure of civil defense. It's done just to terrify people.
It didn't work with me. I was a kid in this era, but I didn't think the Duck and Cover was going to work because I'd grown up in Japan and my father was a chemical engineer and I had a little bit of knowledge about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I knew there wasn't no damn way I was going to duck and cover myself out of that bomb blast. That wasn't going to help anything. So it was just done to terrorize kids and basically set up the beginning of the end of democracy in America and the New World Order.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's interesting about this, of course, this latest film is typical World War II propaganda. They're still producing World War II propaganda, which is interesting.
I know.
Is what World War II really symbolized, this sort of the relationship between the National Security State and the War Department, later the Pentagon, with Hollywood, really that relationship was really sealed. It dates back as early as even Howard Hughes with his movie Hell's Angels. That was also a World War I propaganda film after the fact to promote the war. It was a silent film. But the Churchill himself had established a very pro-British cell to operate in Hollywood to promote pro-British propaganda in the late 30s. An anti-German propaganda. This was called the Quarter Circle. Alexander Quarter, who was a British agent in England, or I'm sorry, in Hollywood, making sure that films came out that promoted British interests. This cultural, the cultural importance, the propaganda value of Hollywood back then was very important. And of course, what we see now today, this movie being produced, the efforts of sort of this pro-British view taking over Hollywood in the 30s and 40s. A good example is Casablanca. It came out in 1942. The thing was being produced before America entered the war. It had to have been.
Sure.
Because it came out in 1942, or some idea of it. I think it was based on a play called Everything Happens at Rick's Place. But this today's Hollywood, with the Zionist propaganda that Hollywood produces so much, it's the British effort in the 30s and 40s sort of foreshadowed today's pro-Zionist propaganda coming out of Hollywood.
It's part of it. I mean, it wasn't just a foreshadow. I mean, it's what was a direct ancestor that led into it.
Mm-hmm. And it was all these movies that came out were very important in shaping people's attitudes during the war, but particularly after the war, because that's when all these movies came out, the war movies of the 50s and 60s, some very good, rather, very good productions. But nonetheless, they were propaganda. They created, they created this image of the war as the good war, as a struggle against evil. And
the evil Adolf Hitler. God, isn't it amazing? I mean, think of it, Tim. Just think about this. So here you have the New World Order with, 9-1-1.
Mm-hmm.
Weren't they lucky to have Adolf Hitler? Gosh darn it. Isn't that something?
He's just lucky, yeah.
Those guys were lucky to have him so they could just sit there and go, oh, man, there's a total, crazy. We got to have the police state. We got to have the snooping. We got to have, blah, blah, yeah. blah. Now 911. They were so lucky to have him. So lucky. And then weren't they also lucky to have someone who would sit there and go, I'm not going to surrender. Mm-hmm. In fact, you'll have to kill all of the German people because the German people should just extinguish itself rather than lose this war. Weren't they lucky to have this guy show up at that time? Gosh darn it. That's just amazing to me.
And thinking about the destruction of the German people, Churchill was an advocate of the Morgenthau Plan.
Yeah.
The Morgenthau Plan, of course, is an actual genocidal document that's actually been produced.
Yeah, as opposed to the ones that haven't.
That haven't been produced, yeah. But no one talks about the Morgenthau Plan and the idea to kill, about 40% of the Germans and turn it back to deindustrialize it and starve everyone to death. Of course, we have the thing like the Rhine Meadow camps, the Eisenhower death camps, where
that stuff is just so sickening. And incidentally, that cesspool Eisenhower. Who is known as a Jew, incidentally. I mean, this is, how he's characterized in his West Point yearbook. he had the same perspective of Germans that Hitler, excuse me, that Churchill did.
Mm-hmm.
That they were kind of a deranged individuals, a race, and they needed to be destroyed. He actually said, "I just hate Germans." Actually, mm-hmm. used the expression, which Churchill did. Now, link that to Yoon Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, isn't it funny how these guys had the exact same position that was then calculated using the psychological sciences, right?
Mm-hmm.
That Yoon Cameron, the lunatic who was using psychic driving in the MK Ultra experiments, right, came up with in terms of the German people, which was then used as one of the planks at Nuremberg, you know, to be able to set up a political control over this the remnants of the people that had been destroyed. So, gee, Tim, it sure looks to me like a cesspool.
And of course, we also have the business contacts, trading contacts that were maintained throughout the war with Standard Oil, General Motors and Ford. Of course, it was the Luftwaffe itself was fueled by tetraethyl.
Yeah, I mean, this is just skull and bones working their end of the deal, where they've got all of the money coming into Germany to create the weapons that can be used to keep the war going. Eustace Mullins documented that at the end of World War I, Michael Wise, a Jewish guy who is the head of the British intelligence services, according to Mullins, was caught by this nurse trying to prolong World War I. And she evidently found food that was being shipped from the Allies, Britain, to the Germans to keep the war going on. She understood what the purpose was, and she produced in a nurse's journal letters of, you know, pointing this out. According to Mullins, she then was captured mysteriously by the Germans and then executed.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get this idea of working to prolong the war, you know, which is just, again, that this theme pops up when you look at the Civil War, you know, which of course then goes into Jefferson Davis and the mysterious, you know, exoneration where Skull and Bones is visible everywhere. When you look at the money that is coming from like Brown Harriman into German industrial entities, which then are creating, you know, you see the stench of the Skull and Bones crowd just everywhere, right? So, yeah, I think we've got, you know, no normal person can look at this collection of data and come to many other kinds of conclusion, Tim. It's a cesspool. I mean, this was basically, you know, a destruction of a people that was being overseen by a secret society that had taken over the political classes of both sides of the conflict, hold them in place and slaughter the people. I mean, you know, it's seems that's what it seemed like to me.
Yeah, that's why you had, you know, IBM had offices at Auschwitz.
You know, yeah, what a shock there. Yeah.
You know, because the Hollander machines or something they used for tracking the people, the numbers. Of course, that implies something completely different than the standard narrative, because if you're just killing people, why are you numbering them? I mean, there's all types of problems with that. But of course, you know, the idea of German, you know, bestial German that activity, the genocide, these things, the Holocaust, that justifies the literal Holocaust of Dresden and Hamburg and Cologne and these things. The raping of Germany by the Red Army as it drove into Germany in 1945.
Just unbelievable.
These things. Operation Keel Hall, the repatriation of these anti-Stalinist forces that had the misfortune of fighting with the German army, hoping that they'd liberate Russia from Stalin. You have Churchill's rhetoric regarding Stalin, calling him a great man, and I like, you know, these things. He's, you know, all those great things he said about Stalin. Of course, you know, if we are to judge Hitler for his crimes, what do we make of Stalin's crimes, which were far worse, despite sheer numbers? Nevertheless, that's okay. Stalin, it was the Grand Alliance with Stalin, but what of his crimes in these things? So, at the very least, the war itself is. Well, it's much more morally ambiguous, if not, you know, it's just than we've been led to believe. And it wasn't just good and bad stuff. And these leaders are not heroes, these supposed leaders.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, you know, we There. I don't think there's ever going to be, sort of like the Holocaust. I don't think we're ever going to find the shrunken heads that were visible, when they came into Buchenwald. I don't think we're ever going to see the human lampshade. Because you see, if these kinds of things were brought forward, then you could have actual scrutiny of them, and the narrative would be exposed as propaganda and false. So as far as like Hitler, man, I think that this guy has been buried to history. I think you're going to have a really hard time getting any hard data on all this. But I think that analytically you can approach the truth. I think that analytically a person can recognize that it's just not possible that one of the more absolutely bizarre and irrational characters in history would accidentally pop up at this point and then create the justification for the new world order. Mm-hmm. I just think, a rational person would say, well, maybe, but maybe not. Maybe there is a plan here. There seems to be a plan to so much else. Looking at 9/11, looking at all the false flag narratives, I think a false flag for Hitler would be very, very plausible. This should be something that gets into the vernacular, right? This should be something that people talk about. Mm-hmm. Think about. Shouldn't just be Tim and Joe.
Speaking of a false flag, of course, we know about Pearl Harbor, these things. There's this Joseph Kennedy was the ambassador in 1940 to Great Britain, Irish Catholic, who didn't get along with Churchill. He was an opponent of American entry into the war. Eventually, he was sacked by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But he's the one talking in his diary about how about Churchill wanting London to be bombed. But there is a funny line here where Kennedy writes that he's going headed back home, and he's traveling on a ship, and he says after a talk with Churchill, Joseph Kennedy, the American ambassador to Britain, noted in his diary, every hour will be spent by the British in trying to figure out how we be gotten in, meaning the war. When he left from Lisbon on a ship to New York, Kennedy pleaded with the State Department to announce that if the ship should happen to blow up mysteriously in the mid-Atlantic, the United States would not consider it a cause for war with Germany. In his unpublished memoirs, Kennedy wrote, I thought this would give me some protection against Churchill's placing a bomb on my ship. And, of course, if you know about the true story around the Lusitania, that is not paranoia.
Can see that, clear-minded people have always had some suspicions about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It's been woven into basically Hollywood movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason why so much of what we have talked about would be incoherent and just shocking to most Americans is because they've gotten their sense of history from Hollywood.
Yeah, they see Dunkirk, they see the Darkest Hour, Schindler's List, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, or maybe Hogan's Heroes, McHale's Navy.
that would be about as close to history as any of the other things, McHale's Navy. And so that's what happens, is that Americans are socialized slowly but surely, and they end up with no capacity to think about any of the history that has led to the current situation where the New World Order, with all the technologic snooping and in the control of some mysterious organization that no one knows who in the hell they are, right, really, is about to really ratchet down on your existence. So,
well, it was Churchill himself. I think I was listening to Fletcher Prouty was talking about this in one of his talks about Churchill. During the war, he himself referred to a high cabal that he himself did not understand. And Disraeli, a predecessor, 19th century prime minister, makes the same observation about we are controlled history and ourselves. We are controlled by persons we never meet.
Yeah.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry. That was it.
I was just going to say that this is the simple truth. Tip. Those statements are clear. And are accurate reflections of everyone's experience.
Even Bill Clinton said that I give orders, no one listens.
Right.
And Lennon said that too, by the way.
Yeah. But you see, therefore, yeah. the common person should take the position that there is no democratic control over the actual activity of government. This is just self-evident.
Oddly enough, democracy makes it worse because it clouds the issue.
Well, right? what is called democracy is just a pageant that is put on to make people not recognize they're enslaved.
Yeah.
Now you can vote for Trump or Clinton. Wow, this is great. It's democracy. Because you hate one or the other, you think it's democratic. There's some kind of democratic process that, you know, your side lost or your side won. It's like a football game.
Yeah, it's interesting because you started out this conversation talking about Freemasonry and was going on with Total War. And Total War is a Freemasonic project. I think that's not a esoteric reading of history. Is if you look at it, the idea of Total War comes out of the French Revolution.
Yes.
And the idea of the Republic, and now it was the People's War. And prior to that, wars were thought of as trifling affairs, or rather conflicts between ruling families. And the idea was you leave the people alone, generally speaking. And this kind of grew out of the 30 Years' War, and sort of, we need to civilize this somewhat. And it worked, at least in Europe, they kind of stuck to this for a while, for a couple centuries. And a story was told to me about the Franco-Prussian War in 1870. Germans had driven into France and Alsace-Lorraine, and the advancing army, the officers, took over a French town, and they paid the French hotel owner gold coins to stay there.
Wow.
This is their war.
Yeah,
this is their idea.
Yeah.
So by that, Total War itself grew out of the idea that
I trace it, Tim, you're absolutely right. It comes from the French Revolution. Yeah. That was where you really had the Masonic control, and where you could see they were actually trying to destroy classes of people.
Yeah.
It wasn't, we have to get rid of the king. It wasn't like a revolution based on, you know, like a royal family kind of thing, where the royal family would have a hard time even raising enough money to get guys together to throw some catapults into some castle, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it was where they had intellectual structure, sophistry, right? They had this clever argument where now we have to kill the bourgeoisie. Right. We have to kill the religious class. We had to kill these classes of people. This is then expanded. You start then seeing the Civil War, where, you know, you American Civil War very much, I think, in this line of escalation of genocide, where, you know, we just have to mow down to the last man. There is no such thing as a political solution. There's no way to surrender and create terms. That's all behind us. It has to be slaughtered down to the last man. And this is occurring, Tim, because what you're seeing now is the control that the secret society has finally gained. They've been working for hundreds of years. When you look at the activity around Jefferson Davis at the end of the Civil War, you can see it in action now, where they control both sides of the political class, both sides of... They control the nations of the world, the European nations. They've slivered into the banking, the political and royal family lineages, and even into the religious lineages. And now they can come up with some clever arguments, push the people together. They've got the technology in terms of weaponry, and they can start wiping them out.
Yep.
And so that's what happened. You know, that is the history, and that is the future if people don't wake the hell up.
And, of course, part of waking up is sort of this iconoclasm, smashing the statues of these false
Winston
gods.
Winston
Churchill. Exactly. There was an excellent article. It was adapted from a speech given by a lecture by the late libertarian historian Ralph Rako on Churchill. Churchill reconsidered, and this is a short paragraph on his conclusion on Churchill. He says, "There is a way of looking at Winston Churchill as very tempting, that he was a deeply flawed creature, who was summoned at a critical moment to do battle with a uniquely appalling evil, and whose very flaws contributed to a glorious victory. In a way, like Merlin in C.S. Lewis's great Christian novel, That Hideous Strength. Such a judgment would, I believe, be superficial. A candid examination of his career, I suggest, yields a different conclusion. That, when all is said and done, Winston Churchill was a man of blood, a politico without principle, whose apotheosis serves to corrupt every standard of honesty and morality in politics and history." That's a, I think, pretty fair summation of at least Winston Churchill.
You know, I disagree. I would say that is on the way to a fair.
Yes, yeah.
but it's not all the way.
Given our talk tonight,
I'll tell you what's good about that is, like you were saying, how do we transition people? Well, mm-hmm. one thing you've got to do is you've got to throw these icons into the ditch.
Mm-hmm.
Can't sit here and go FDR was, you know, New Deal, Social Security, right? You have to see new FDR as a sexual degenerate, you know, that leads to Kinsey having influence in terms of our legal system.
That's true, because George H.W. Bush wasn't the first sexual degenerate in a wheelchair.
touche. Yeah, well, so anyway, this is the thing, is that we've got to put these icons in the ditch. And that description at least is on the way.
Yes.
But you have to go further. You've got to say, wait a second. These guys could not. They're not just flawed. They're way beyond flawed. They are lifetime actors. What you're seeing are genocidists masquerading as political leaders and lying constantly to try to create the structure. That the narrative, you know, this kind of dance that they do to set up the political dynamics. So now it's time to launch the weapons. And that, of course, will mean to wipe out, you know, 80% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
That's a shame, but it's total war. And by God, look, we got them. they're dead. We're all dead too, but not a problem because mm-hmm. we won. I mean, it's like the idiot Britons dancing at the end of World War I. Celebrating the victory over the Axis. Oh, my God, like they won the war, right? Except, millions and millions of their racial brothers were dead, and their economy was crushed, and World War II was just around the corner, and so they were sitting there, you know, dancing and celebrating. I mean, obviously, when war ends, it's a natural impulse.
Well, there's this thing with Churchill. I think he's a comment. In 1945, as he's surveying the situation in the exhaustion of German power, he goes, what's there between the white cliffs of Dover and the Russian white steppes? Well, Winston, if you thought about what do you think was going to happen with this war, if you wipe out Germany, you create this vacuum, of course, can't you look at a map? Can't you foresee this? Well, the reality is, of course he could foresee this. He's writing these down for history. Right.
Exactly.
He knows exactly what's going on there. It's not like, well, who could have foreseen that we'd have a Cold War?
Ken Burns, LBJ going, oh my God, I don't know what to do. I mean, heck, we need to invade, I guess. I mean, LBJ doesn't know that the Gulf of Tonkin was a false flag.
Yeah.
I mean, LBJ doesn't know that sending American squads in tiny numbers into the jungle is going to create an enormous amount of casualties. He doesn't know that, spraying herbicide over the entire country is going to, you know, basically kill tens of thousands of people. Look, they know this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what we get, it's all BS, every single line. The New York Times, The coverage of the Homolador was probably like as real as anything else in the New York Times. I mean, it's just complete fiction. It's fiction in how they present it, but moreover, what they're presenting is fiction in the beginning.
Yeah, and of course, good example is a lot of the speeches that the English people heard that aroused them to stand up to Hitler wasn't Churchill, it was that actor, Norman Thomas. Is it Norman Thomas?
Yeah,
so they hired an actor because either he was too tired.
He was drunk all the time.
Yes.
And no one could understand what he was saying. So they got some guy that had a grumbly voice. I mean, I guess
They call it war theater, right? Where the European theater, the Pacific theater, the Iwo Jima Memorial, the picture taken, the iconic photograph that was posed, wasn't genuine. These things are all fake. It's a show. I mean, it isn't saying there isn't destruction, there isn't death, and there isn't misery, but the whole point is that's part of the production.
You know, it's just a big matrix with propaganda everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the first thing is, okay, you know, we're in a very bad situation, obviously. The political class, the financial class, the rulers, the oligarchs are a secret society, and they intend to genocide us and are in the process of it. And maybe even worse, intend to structure us as intellectually feeble slaves, as in Huxley's Brave New World. What to do? Well, first thing is stop the damage, you know, stop the propaganda, turn off the crap, recognize and tell people that mainstream media is a weapon. It's not just a cesspool, you know, it's a design weapon. And part of the weapon, and this is why our little talk we're having tonight is, I think, you know, timely, because you've got this cesspool movie coming out, you know, Winnie the Pooper.
And you have to and you have to ask why it's coming out, which is...
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. And here it is, you're trying to, you know, recreate this old Masonic load of rubbish who is just there to kill the Europeans. They're trying to create all, they're trying to regen this, you know, oh my God, here we are, you know, the ultimate evil is right there across the you know, they'll be on our, you know, fighting us and killing us up. So it's okay to commit to total war. You know, mm-hmm. It's okay to have total war. I mean, you know, the movie would be great if they would just go, let's look at the movie from the perspective of the civilians in Dresden, mm-hmm. or Hamburg. Let's look at that story. Here is the story of the glorious Winston Churchill. How about the civilians that were burned to death?
Yeah, let's throw children melting into the street, or yeah, being burned to death by melting street.
Streets. Yeah. About that, you know, where is the glory, you know, in that? The British bulldog Churchill, we'll fight them on the streets and blah blah blah. You know, why don't you tell the truth, Churchill? We will burn the children. We will evaporate women, right? We will destroy a race. And the reason for it, there isn't any. We're just going to do it. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry, buddy. You got to explain this. You see, the people should have been demanding it then. They should have been saying, no, you've got to explain why you're going to do it. The population have to stop being so pacific and docile. When the political class just creates a, you know, some little bizarre narrative to, you know, throw them off guard, we need to develop more skepticism, which stems from the only place it comes from, more hard data, the schematic. We've got to build out the schematic. I think that our show does a good job of being part of it. Hundreds of scholars now are involved in this quest. You know, E. Michael Jones, I could name two. They come at it from different points of view. There are differences, but the schematic is getting built out piece by piece. And that's why shows like this, you know, I don't think we did too much original work. We may have like made some connections that hadn't been made before, but nevertheless, we're helping to build out the schematic, you know, this is what's got to get done, because, you know, it's a crisis in terms of time and of consequence.
Exactly. So, exactly. Well, Joe, I think we covered it, you think?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much, Tim.
Joe, be safe out there.
I'm still here next week. I'm looking to the mountains right now, and I don't see any flames for the first time in a couple of days. So next week I'll be here.
Excellent. Okay. So talk next week. Thank you.